Ways and Means. We're continuing our discussion of the Department of Education. Ms. Fleming, if she will come forward and maybe give the committee just a little bit of a brief. We're changing basically a little bit our schedule and what we'll be doing today or what you'll be presenting to us today.
Good morning, Chair Devlin and members of the committee. For the record, Deputy Superintendent Vicki Fleming, Oregon Department of Education. Our budget analyst has changed this morning, and Bill McGee will be sitting in for Linda Ames as she's next door with another agency beginning their hearings. Basically, this morning we wanted to change the game plan a bit because of the kinds of questions you were asking yesterday. And we had intended to go through the agency and talk about our reorganization and talk about the role of the changing role of the agency. We'd still like the opportunity to talk about that with you, but in light of your questions yesterday, we decided to switch this morning's presentation to really talk first about outcomes in the system and then second give you kind of a grounding in the mechanics of the state school fund so we can answer all of your questions about those two things. Dr. Burke will be coming up to talk about the annual report that you have in your notebook, and then Brian Reeder will come up and talk about the mechanics of the state school fund. And if we have time at the end of the morning this morning, we'd like to go back to that role of the agency, changing role as we've reorganized and reinvented ourselves over the last couple of years. So I'd just like to add a couple of things relative to that performance measure discussion, and I know you had a lot of questions about that, and Senator Whitsitt in particular was dismayed by the lack of information in that notebook. And so I just want to reiterate that the reason and the NA that is referenced on those pages in that report is not available, rather than not applicable, it means that we didn't collect the information because it wasn't going to be meaningful to us in our long-term agency metrics because of the reorganization. So that's why we're going back, doing the strategic plan, and setting progress benchmarks for ourselves, both internally and externally, that will really inform our progress. I'm told by Jeff Tryons, the director of the Progress Board, that agencies sometimes are accused of playing a game with changing their performance measures, so they're never held accountable for anything, and I can assure you that that's not the case for us. We are very much interested in performance management and continuous improvement in the agency and in the system, and we have spent a lot of time and energy to position the agency and the work units in the agency to be able to do that better. And so you can ask us whatever you like about that, and we can fill in the blanks as we go. So with that, if it's pleasure of the chair, Dr. Brick would come up and begin a conversation with you about the information that is in our annual report. It tells about Oregon schools.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For your record, I'm Pat Burke. I'm the Chief Policy Officer for the Department of Education. My task today is to discuss performance outcomes of the educational system. Now, performance is a tricky word when it comes to understanding a system. For example, when you invest in something, you have a natural desire to know how your investment is doing. But the answer to that question is sometimes complex. If you own stock in a company, for example, right now, at this time of year, you're receiving annual reports and tax statements. You have a basic question. How did my stock do? Did I make a profit on my investment? The answer to that is typically much more complex than the question. You look at price-earning ratios, performance over time, costs of production, long-term debt, tax implications, return on investment over time, market share, customer demographics, new products, and so on. So the answer to the question, how is my investment doing, is usually answered by data and analysis that looks at the complexity of the whole. The better information you have, the better prepared you are to understand your investment. policymakers, such as the legislature, educators, and the general public, have the same question about the investment they make in their educational system. How are our schools doing? The answer to this question also has data and analysis to look at the complexity of the system. And again, the better the information, the better the understanding of the question. And I'm going to be referring to the Oregon State Report Card throughout this brief presentation. You have a copy of that document in your notebook. The document is also available on the website. And I think you will find, I hope you will find, that it's a rich source of information on the outcomes of the Oregon education system. So let's first talk about academics and how Oregon students are doing academically. People in education, such as myself, get accused fairly often, and I believe rightly so, of using a lot of terms that no one else uses except them. Every profession has its share of jargon, and we are, of course, no exception. But the basics of our outcomes are fairly straightforward. First, what do we want students to know and be able to do? We call this content. And when we arrange content from kindergarten through 12th grade and we establish certain expectations at certain times, we call those standards. How do we know our students are learning it? These are tests and measures, different forms of assessments. Some of those assessments are done at a local school level, some are done at a state level, some are done at the national level. And how well do we expect them to know it? These are performance levels, and it's a very important third part of the system. For example, if we were to say that all students should know how to take care of themselves through exercise, that's a piece of content, a piece of knowledge that we would expect them to have. And if I have my students demonstrate that by having them run a mile, I've added a measure to that. But if I say that all students by the eighth grade should be able to run a mile in under 10 minutes, I have added a measure of performance against which I judge the performance of all of my students. Now, the same basic principle applies to reading and math and science and so on. We can ask if all students can do something that we have identified as a goal, and can they do it to a certain level, or can only some students do that? And if we can identify those who have made more progress to come up to that level of expected performance, we have a very valuable tool with which to work with students. This is very different than just looking at averages, because if you look at an average, it just won't tell you what you need to know to help students. And we've all experienced this. Most of us have a driver's license. We got that license because the state of Oregon established a body of knowledge that it expected all of us to know. It gave us a test on the rules of the road. But we also had to get in a car and demonstrate to a knowledgeable and trained evaluator that we could operate that vehicle to a standard. If we couldn't do it, we didn't get the license, but we also knew what we needed to do to improve. Plumbers and surgeons all have to demonstrate their professional skill. This came home to me very clearly as a parent several years ago. My son is now 27, and he's a pilot. And when he was 16, my wife and I were standing on the tarmac at Evergreen Field in Vancouver, watching our only child take off for his first solo flight. As he flew the pattern around the field and he turned and he lined up to make his first solo landing, he turned into the wind and I could see his wings start to wobble in the air. And I remember saying to myself, I know this sounds a bit odd, but shows you how I think about these things. I said to myself, oh Lord, I hope he wasn't trained under a bell curve. And the reason was, if he was trained under a bell curve, it would have been okay for him to perform at a substandard level about half the time. That's not acceptable when you're landing an airplane. Certainly not when my son is landing an airplane for the first time. I wanted to know that he was trained to land that plane appropriately every time, and that his training should prepare him to do that. He knew what he needed to know, he knew what the criteria were, and he could do it. And this is the basic question in an education system. Do we know what we want students to know? Do we have criteria to measure it? And can they do it? So let's look at some of the outcomes. How are students doing in achieving those standards? In slide 31, you see performance in reading. And you see it by benchmarks at grades 3, 5, 8, and 10. And what do we see in this slide? First, we notice that third grade and fifth grade students are accelerating over time. The bottom part of the chart shows the years from 1991 through the present. This is the percent of students meeting standard, and you have third grade, fifth grade, eighth grade, and tenth grade results. We also see that a certain amount of difference is expected. As these tests get more difficult, the standards get more difficult, the tests get more difficult over time, and you would expect to see a certain difference in performance. You also notice that by 8th and 10th grade, the overall academic achievement has slowed at those two grade levels. Looking at slide 32, we look at basically the same information for mathematics. We notice that third and fifth grade mathematics has dramatically improved, up over 80% of third and fifth graders meeting or exceeding state standard. But we also see the flattening of improvement at the 8th and 10th grade levels that we saw in the other slide, especially in the last few years. So this is one of the ways we use data. This is one of the trends in the outcomes that has caused us to identify literacy and middle and high school improvement as key initiatives for us. Another way to look at our outcomes is to ask, how are we doing compared with other states? And how are we doing compared with states in the Western region and the United States? Slide 33 shows you the historical results for Oregon in the National Assessment of Educational Progress. This is sometimes called the NAEP assessment. NAEP is the only national comparative academic assessment that we have. And you notice that Oregon fourth grade mathematics is accelerating and exceeds both the Western states and the nation. In slide 34, we look at similar information for eighth grade mathematics, and it shows the same pattern. And I might parenthetically add here that the eighth grade mathematics for African American students in particular was very strong and exceeded the region and the nation in terms of growth. There's more data in the report card on this level of assessment on pages 18 through 23 in your report card. Another key question is, how well prepared are Oregon students for further education after they graduate from high school? This is also a very key outcome. I would refer you in this case to page 25 in the report card, not on the slides. And on page 25 in the report card, you will find that 56% of Oregon students took the SAT exam, the Scholastic Aptitude Test. This is the most common form in Oregon of an assessment for preparation for college. And those two math scores, as you can, and reading score, math and verbal score, far exceed the national average, as you can see, and actually represent the number two level in the United States behind Washington State, which had a one-point improvement over Oregon. But we'd like to point out that Washington only tested 52% of its kids. So which in the last several years, Washington and Oregon have been actually at the top in the nation in terms of SAT performance. So by these measures, one would conclude that Oregon students are doing quite well. We're seeing a general trend in improvement in outcome at both the elementary level, in particular on state standards, and on preparation for college. But as you heard yesterday, we have focused our accountability conversation as an agency not just on the averages, but on the success of all Oregon students.
Mr. Burke, before you go on, I had one question. In terms of the 3rd, 5th, 8th, and 10th grade scores, and these are averages, how significant are the differences between those levels of improvement, in a sense? I mean, for instance, I'll go away from these and I'll use an SAT example.
Yes.
What's the real difference between maybe a 530 on a verbal and a 540 on a verbal in terms of, and how would it compare to like this? I mean, the differences between these scores, if something is truly scored on a 500-point level, how significant is, we're showing a general trend of an improvement in third and fifth, but how significant of an improvement is that over that period of time?
Well, if you compare that, Mr. Chair, to the improvement of the nation as a whole, it's fairly significant because it is considerably above the national averages and has remained above the national averages. If that is a statistically significant difference, I don't have that information in my head. I can tell you that both SAT and ACT have, we've done alignments of Oregon standards to those measures. So we know that there is a strong correlation between performance on Oregon assessments and performance on the SAT, for example. The correlation in the most recent study that I've seen between performance on the SAT and 10th grade performance in Oregon was a 0.75. So, as you know, a perfect correlation would be 1. So a 0.75 correlation between 10th grade and performance on the SAT is really quite high. So we feel that there's at least strong alignment between Oregon State standards and these other measures. Thank you.
Please proceed.
The next question I'd like to talk about then is how well are Oregon students doing on these outcomes if we look at them by race and ethnicity. Slide 35 looks at third grade elementary reading. Now, there are two things that you would want to notice about this slide. First of all, we're looking at data from 1996 to the most recent data in 2004. And you'll notice for third grade reading, there is a general upward improvement in reading during that period of time. But in this particular slide, we are also looking at the information broken down by subgroup. The technical term that we use sometimes is the data are disaggregated or they are broken into subgroups. And you notice in 1996 the size of what is called the achievement gap, that is the differences between scores, the average score follows this line, and you'll notice that the scores for racial and ethnic groups were quite, the gap was quite significant. If you go out to the most recent data here, you'll notice that that gap has narrowed and that the performance of most students has not only continued to improve, but the achievement gap has narrowed, with the very obvious and important exception of Latino students in the state. However, if we look at slide 36, the next slide, we're now looking at 10th grade data over the same period of time. And you will notice that in the 10th grade data, the scores do not, in general, show that gradual level of improvement, nor do we see the narrowing of the achievement gap that we saw at the elementary level. In fact, what we see in some cases is the achievement gap is getting wider. Now, let me say a word here about why we think accountability is job one. The Oregon report card currently, I'm talking about the Oregon State report card for schools and districts, currently does not require that we look at this level of analysis. If we were to just look at averages, we would not see the pattern that I'm showing you right now. But if we are to hold ourselves and Oregon schools accountable for achievement for all students, we must look at all of our data in this way, to ask tough questions, to align our priorities, and to be clear about our goals.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Gordon.
Thank you. Good morning, Dr. Burke.
Good morning, Senator.
I'd like to ask the question about the slide, but also the statement that you just made. I was reading this morning an article from the American Educational Research Association. It's titled Closing the Gap, High Achievement for Students of Color. This is an organization that puts out information for public policymakers. I'm sure you're
familiar with the organization, yes.
But in this edition, Fall 2004, Volume 2, Issue 3, they point out, and I'm reading from the document, we also know that what students are taught is one of the most powerful predictors of how they will perform on achievement tests. Despite policies calling for equal opportunities to learn, minority students often do not have a chance to study as rigorous a curriculum as more privileged students, and they also are less likely to be taught by teachers with high levels of experience. The report goes on to say that, in addition, negative stereotypes concerning academic ability can interfere with minority students' academic persistence. Would you please comment on this as it relates to the information you are illustrating?
I'd be happy to. Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, you have raised what is truly at the core of the conversation about eliminating the achievement gap, particularly at the secondary level. One of the reasons that we see or that we have a concern when looking at these data, difference between third and fifth grade and high school, is that there are some very important structural differences in curriculum and instruction that occur in high school, not the least of which is who gets access to what courses. And the assumption, if you will, this is an oversimplification, but most students in the third and fifth grade level get exposed to basically the same academic content. That is not true at high school. Through a variety of reasons, both personal choice of students as well as placement in courses by test score or other mechanism, students are not exposed to the same level of content. Now, how does that play out in academic achievement? The 10th grade assessment and the Oregon assessment test basically the content of algebra and both beginning and advanced algebra, sometimes what we would call algebra 1 or algebra 2, geometry, basic understanding of statistics and probability, and math problem solving. Now, that is usually contained in a set of courses. So, Senator, the basic answer to your question, and I think what the AERA article is talking about, is if I've not exposed all of my students to that level of coursework, it is likely that students will not do as well. And the degree to which patterns of that exist by poverty and by ethnicity, you can see that the structure of the curriculum reinforces this pattern of underachievement. Simply, students learn what we teach them, and they have a tendency not to learn what we don't teach them. So if they're not exposed to the content, they do not do as well. This is why we have looked at and are looking at high school reform, particularly within the context of accelerating student achievement and exposing more students to more rigorous curriculum as a key part of our high school initiative. The issue that you brought up, by the way, Senator, on teachers, I will be addressing later this morning.
If I may follow up, and I appreciate your response, Dr. Burke. What this research document that I am referring to says that public policymakers should do is, first, support programs that engage all students in a rigorous standards-based curriculum, provide additional time and instruction as needed, but do not lower expectations. It goes on to talk about the kind of environment that is necessary to support learning, support for teachers, administrators, parents, and to understand that school districts are producers as well as consumers of research, and that it's important to invest in collecting evidence of the long-term effects of efforts to raise academic achievement, which goes to the assessment piece that you all will be talking about at some point as well. So thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, if you don't mind, I would love that reference. It sounds like an article that I would really enjoy reading. I certainly agree with everything that you just read.
Mr. Burke, we have one additional question. Senator Walker.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Burke, I don't know if I'm confused or maybe I'm not, but I'm looking at third grade reading and then we go to 10th grade reading. Is there nothing in between that you test for? And my question, I raise it because how do we know when the disconnect occurs? When do we know that students stop achieving in reading and start going downhill and this gap widens?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, thank you. In the interest of time, I was only trying to look at the bookends. You will see in the report card There are actually 8 different slides, 4 in reading and 4 in mathematics, okay, that look at 3rd grade, 5th grade, 8th grade, and 10th grade, so that you will be able to track that information all the way through. In the future, because of No Child Left Behind, we are adding this year assessments at the 4th grade level, at the 6th grade level, and at the 7th grade level. No Child Left Behind requires assessments annually from 3rd grade through 8th grade. So in the future, we will not only have those 4 levels, but we will be able to connect the dots all the way through from 3rd grade through 8th grade. What you will see when you look at those 4 slides together in either reading or mathematics, that there is a noticeable difference between 3rd and 5th grade and 8th grade. We begin to see some separation at the 8th grade level in both reading and mathematics. And again, going back to my answer to Senator Gordley, that is also an area where you begin to see some differentiation of instruction. One of the things that we are looking at is making sure that all students receive a rigorous content exposure throughout schooling. We're also very interested. We have proposed, as part of our review of the accountability plan, looking at longitudinal growth. Let me explain what I mean. A school could be performing, in terms of the federal definition for adequate yearly progress. They currently have to hit a threshold of 40% meeting or exceeding standard. That threshold is going to rise to 50% this year. So a school this year could be, and actually for the past 3 years, could be right at 41%, and the definition says that they made adequate yearly progress. Whereas another school that might have started at 20% not meeting and rises all the way to 39% meeting, that school is considered a failure because it didn't achieve the 40% threshold. That is not to say that we wouldn't want all kids to be at that 40% or 50% or 100% threshold. But there is a difference between the school that really grew and is not recognized and the school that didn't grow at all and is recognized. So we are looking at longitudinal models that will connect these dots more accurately and look at the growth of those schools over time. We need a little bit better data to do that, and that's what we're working on.
All right, thank you.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Burke, I think that's exactly the point that we need to focus on, and that is testing children into the grade level and testing them out of their grade level and finding out the improvement during that instructional period. Averages don't mean much. I mean, when we're comparing against a national average that is substandard, I don't want to say they're failing, but they're 50% of them aren't meeting performance levels. The graphs don't tell us too much, and you're absolutely right. The teacher who does a very good job of taking a class from point A to point B, but point B isn't quite at the performance level, has done a heck of a job, and they get penalized for it. And if I could give just a short anecdote.
Yes.
When I was in the seventh grade, we it was a small school, Powell Butte School, four classrooms. We changed teachers, and about the third day, Guy Delamarty came into the class. He wondered what we were doing, and he said, "We're doing math." He said, "No, you're counting your fingers." The next week, he essentially closed the school down except for math. I don't know what the standards were in the classrooms, but in our classrooms, it was 3 figures in your head, 3 column figures in your head. You know, it's addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division. And it took about 2 weeks, and he fixed it. I went on to become an outstanding math student at Central Oregon College after 2 years when I got my Associate of Arts, and it wasn't me. He fixed the problem. And I think that when we have kids that can't do math and we can't do reading and writing, we need to stop what we're doing and teach them then. Mm-hmm. Not just move them on. We need to address the problem at the point. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, first of all, I appreciate your very concrete example. And what we have been working with the Oregon University community on is instead of expecting teachers to learn one way of teaching something. We hope that all of our teachers begin to develop multiple ways of approaching information so that students, different needs of students and students that are in need of extra assistance, teachers are better prepared to meet those needs in the classroom.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another way, another key question of looking at the data is, does doing well academically really matter? It's a basic question. Do our standards actually help students prepare for the future? Now, I've given you a separate handout, and I know it looks a little funny, but I'd like to explain it. It's a set of three charts. It looks like this.
Members, it should have been on your dais this morning.
Those funny S-curves on that chart, you see a chart for reading, a chart for math, and a chart for writing. Those are probability curves. Along the bottom, you see the scale for the Oregon assessment in either reading, mathematics, or science. And on the left-hand side, you see the probability of achieving a certain grade point average in the first year of an Oregon college or university. The arrows at the bottom point to the scores that either meet or exceed the 10th grade standard. So what this chart shows is the probability of getting a certain GPA based upon a student's 10th grade assessment. These three charts are drawn from two much larger studies of the Oregon University system that align students in Oregon community colleges and universities based upon how they did as 10th graders in the Oregon State Assessment. This is an example of how we have been able to refine our technology and use data more precisely. A perfect probability would be 1.0. Now, as you can see from any of the charts, the probability of getting at least a grade point average of 2.0 is greatly improved when a student meets the 10th grade standard and is dramatically improved when the student exceeds those standards. Now, we know from these same studies that the grade point average in the first year of college of 2.7 or higher is a strong predictor of whether the student will persist toward a degree in 4 years. Why is that important? Well, the average in the Oregon University system of getting a degree within 4 years is about 28% of the students who start. If you go out 6 years, it goes up to about 51%, which means that almost half the students in our system end up leaving college without a degree, without job skills in many cases, and with accumulated debt because they've been borrowing money to pay tuition. So using information in this way as early as the 10th grade gives us a way of working with kids around their academic preparation and better preparing them to make progress within that 4-year period of time toward a degree. This is extremely beneficial to counselors and teachers to have at the end of the sophomore year. That gives us 2 full years to work with kids. Now, since we can very clearly demonstrate the connection between high school and higher ed, you can also see here why we have identified better integration of pre-kindergarten through 12th grade, community colleges and universities in our system as a key strategy. These outcomes are the glue that hold the educational pre-K through 16 enterprise that Vicki Fleming talked about yesterday. This is the glue that holds them together.
Dr. Burke, Senator Gordley, you had another question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not a question, just a comment. I'm looking at the Oregon benchmark number 24, which is some college, and the performance measure 12 says racial and ethnic minorities enrolled in community colleges as a percent of the state average. When you look at what the data reveals, which is a and this is performance measure, performance measure 12. It says that for 2003, the percentage of minorities enrolled in community colleges compared to the Oregon population ranges from 106% to 114%. This is a clear decrease from the earlier years. However, the year 2003 reflected the application of the 2000 census percentages. The year 2004 saw a further reduction of the percent of minorities served compared to the general population. Also, as Oregon community colleges increase tuition by a greater percent than ever before, this will affect the minority student enrollment. This will need to be monitored. I read this as it relates to, again, what you're presenting to us and showing the linkages.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, there are clear linkages, and it also represents why this focus on increasing rigor is so important to us.
Dr. Burke, I had one question, and I know we need to get on with the presentation and try to stay on schedule, but this is almost a rhetorical question, so you don't really need to respond. In terms of closing the achievement gap and looking at those 10th grade scores, the average constituent that I would have, well, they would be very much in favor of closing that achievement gap in reading or in any of the other areas. They would be very much also in favor of raising very substantially the number of students, that percentage of students that met those requirements.
Sure.
So the question basically, and we won't have to answer it today, is how you do both simultaneously.
Yeah.
How you continue to improve the number of students overall that are improving in terms of, and still bringing the achievement gap up simultaneously, not doing one or the other, but doing both.
Mr. Chair, I won't spend a lot of time on this, but I would like to take the opportunity to seize upon your question and to reinforce why we are currently engaged in overhauling the state accountability system. One of the pluses on the Oregon report card is that the Oregon report card does do exactly what you just described in terms of data. It looks at not only students that come up to the standard, but also looks at are students continuing to grow even after they have met the standard. The current federal model does not do that. And what we are engaged in is trying to integrate these systems, and one of the goals of that integration is to do more of exactly what you described, continuing to look at students even after they have met the state standards.
Okay. Please proceed.
The Oregon legislature has established two measures that we expect students to be able to do prior to leaving high school. That's to earn a diploma, which the legislature defines as 22 units of credit, and to demonstrate proficiency on state standards in English and in mathematics. So how are we doing on that particular goal? I'm going to ask you to refer to page 28 in the booklet, in your booklet, the Oregon Report Card. Here again, we see the importance of looking at outcomes both in the overall and for each group. Looking at the far right of the chart on page 28 in the right-hand column, you see that the percentage of students graduating with a regular diploma and meeting English and mathematics standards has steadily increased over the past 3 years. But, as we've seen in other measures, we see slight improvement among Hispanic and African American students, but still a large gap in this important outcome measure. These are the measures that tell us that we are on the right track by asking tough accountability questions of ourselves, of districts, and of universities, and for sponsoring our own initiatives in middle school and high school achievement, secondary school instruction in literacy, and targeted services to students of color. These results must be improved. On page 30 of the same document, it provides more explicit detail about the students completing high school. In the upper left-hand corner, you see that 36,000 students roughly completed high school in 2003, and you see the breakdown of how they did. On page 32, if you just flip one more page, you will find the information related to Senator Gordley's question of yesterday regarding high school dropout data by race and ethnicity over time. Is it getting better? Here again, the richness of the data helps us understand the problem better. The dropout rate is declining for all groups, especially and very dramatically for Hispanic youth. That's remarkably good news. But the rates for African American and Hispanic and Native American students still exceed white and Asian Pacific Islanders. But we do, by breaking this information up into subgroups and looking at it over time, we get a much better picture of how we're doing. Now I'll refer you to slide 39. How successful are we at keeping Oregon students engaged in school? This slide shows that we can account for over 99% of students who begin high school in Oregon schools. And as this slide demonstrates, 68.9% of our students finish high school in 4 years with a regular diploma. 17.4% of those students have dropped out over time, over that same four-year period of time. But we also see another group of students that we are very concerned about in our work. 5.9% of students have attended for 4 years, but they did not drop out, but they did not earn a diploma in that period of time. Now, they might. They can come back for a fifth year. They can come back for a sixth year. As you can see in the chart, some get a GED. Some go to community colleges and so on. But this picture, I think, demonstrates why making high schools smaller, more personal, and more engaging of students is such a high priority for us. Now, let me...
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Walker.
Thank you. Dr. Burke, where are we nationally in this comparison? Where it's, 17.4% dropout rate, 68.9% getting a regular diploma. Where does that compare?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Walker, it's an excellent question. Believe it or not, we are right at the national average. National average of high school graduation. Remember the question, it's important to understand the question that this chart asks. It says, of all the students who started 4 years ago, how many of those students in 4 years graduate on time with a regular diploma? So it doesn't include everyone. For example, students with learning disabilities who get a modified diploma are removed from the sample. Okay. Students who get a GED are removed from the sample. So it's not everyone. And right around 69-70% nationally is about the average. That doesn't mean that 30% of kids dropped out of school. It means that a number of things happened to that other 30%. For example, as you can see in this chart in Oregon, unfortunately, 55 of those students died during the time that they were in high school. That's a very common occurrence for teachers who teach medically fragile students in high school. We, in fact, have students who pass away during the time that they are in school. So as you can see from the chart, we can account for just about every kid that comes through our doors.
We also, I would caution you that the suicide is the second leading cause of death of our young people, so I'm sure some of these students reflect those.
They are. Adolescent suicide is a very serious problem and is part of our guidance and comprehensive guidance plan that we have developed. I want to address a little bit of diversity. You saw yesterday on slide 9, we won't go back to it, but you saw the growth of diversity in our state. You also saw the growth in the percentage of students in poverty in Oregon increasing over time to a current level of 40%. I refer you now to slide 37 in your notebook that shows the breakdown of some of the over 130 languages that are spoken in Oregon schools. This chart accounts for only 90% of those. There are actually a number of other languages that we could identify. Clearly, one of the challenges facing our schools today is a student population that is far more diverse, poorer, and less fluent in English than in any time in Oregon's history. If you turn to slide 40, you will see how these numbers have changed from 1980 to the present. And I know I'm moving fairly quickly, but page 49 of the report card, you will notice that while student diversity has continued to increase, the diversity of staff has not. This dramatically highlights the reason for focusing on cultural competence of staff and the level of preparation and success in diverse classrooms, both of which are key issues in our work. Senator Gordley, you raised a question earlier about teacher quality. I'd like to spend a brief moment on that. What do we know about the teachers in Oregon with whom we've entrusted these challenges? Slide 38 shows that 87.1% of all Oregon teachers meet the definition of being highly qualified. And this number in regular elementary classes, those that would be identified as self-contained, is actually over 96%. But we also see, just as Senator Gordley's question highlighted, that high-poverty schools struggle with the lowest numbers of teachers who meet this definition, reflecting a trend throughout the country that we have not yet found a way to get our best-trained teachers into our highest-need schools. On page 53 in the report card, we provide an additional view. I think it's important to note that Oregon has the highest percentage of teachers with advanced degrees of any of the states in the Northwest. Oregon has a strong teacher corps with high standards for licensure and high levels of preparation. There are many other outcome indicators in these data that time does not allow us to go through. I hope you are able to spend some time with this document and explore the information on special education, early childhood education programs, alternative education programs, school and district report cards, adequate yearly progress, and so on. I have only hit on some of the highlights. Now, in conclusion, let me say that this agency produces a rich variety of data that can provide a clear picture of the outcomes being produced by education in our state. Our agency sees this type of open, detailed, and disaggregated data as an essential element in providing you and the taxpayers of our state a system that is accountable for results. The data give us essential tools to manage the results and to have clear indicators of progress. In this type of analysis, we are able to more precisely identify our strengths and weaknesses and understand better how to prioritize resource allocation, identify professional development needs, and identify where there are schools and districts that may need more direct support and intervention to improve. What we have seen in this data this morning is that our system is doing well. We have outcomes that indicate that our students are achieving. But we also see data that tell us that we can and must do better. We are going beyond the averages and asking tough questions about how all students are doing, those who are already exceeding the standard, as well as those for whom the achievement gap must be closed. This is not the kind type of accountability that you have seen before. We are not sugarcoating our results. We see our strengths and we see our challenges, and this clarity of focus helps us design strategies that will move this enterprise forward. We look forward to discussing these strategies with you as we progress through these hearings. Thank you for your attention and patience this morning. That concludes my presentation, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Yes, Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much. And thank you for an excellent presentation this morning. Just a comment and some historical perspective for the committee. Prior to the Castillo administration, we fought the previous administration to get this aggregated data on all of our Oregon students. And when I say we fought, that's exactly what I mean. It was in the waning days of the previous administration that we finally got a first cut at, a first look at disaggregated data on all of our schools in Oregon. And it is because of the quality of leadership that Superintendent Castillo has brought forward and leadership of Dr. Burke and others in the department that we're now able to look at this data as a diagnostic tool. That's what it is. It's a diagnostic tool that helps us better understand what's going on out there in our districts, and that allows us to have a better understanding of how we can improve the quality of instruction and best serve all of our students' needs. So again, I just needed to put where we are in historical perspective, because we haven't always been doing this work. It just started within the last few years, 3 or 4 years.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the presentation, Dr. Burke. I'm going to give you some bullet points, and I hope maybe they'll come up in the presentations later this week. It's my opinion, or reviewing this data, the mathematics problem solving is a big problem we need to address. You talked about math, but not the problem solving aspect. We're told in this data that we had a 2,702 student enrollment decline in 2003-2004. Do we know what the number is going to be in 2005-2006? I'd like to know about the homeless liaison coordinator in the school district, how effective that's been. On page 53, you give some staff statistics. I'd like to know how that compares to other states. Dr. Burke talked about the experience level of our teachers and how many have a graduate degree. Is that a plus or minus? On page 56, our state requires so many hours of instruction. That's the requirement. But we hear every day that we need more school days. Now, how does that relate? I'd like a status on the Title IIIC troops to teachers. I hope you're going to comment on the Talented and Gifted program. And on the medical benefits, that's a big problem for us, and we're going to be looking at when we get down to budget numbers. I've been told that some school districts have negotiated paying their teachers for medical benefits when they retire and are paying that out of general funds. Is that legal? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. I did have also an additional request for some information. On the dropout figures given on page 39, I guess the general assumption would be those that attended 4 years with no diploma actually lacked either whatever your unit of measurement would be, units or credits, to graduate. Could we get some data to see, just in a sense, what percentage of the students were close to having the number of credits to graduate? I think it says something for a student to attend for 4 years and not be able to get the minimum number of credits within that period of time. I wouldn't want to go back to the system when I was in high school, which was basically, we, forgive me for the gender specific, but it was called a gentleman's D. If you sat in the classroom and kept quiet, you at least got a D.
That wasn't me.
No. So, and the other question actually has to do with, I've seen it identified in other areas, but for the committee, some identification of the reasons students drop out, what we're finding in terms of why they drop out. Any additional requests? Senator Whitsitt.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Dr. Burke, the quality education model recommends an increased number of credits required for graduation. Are you planning to address that in the near future in the curriculum?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, we are looking at that, yes. It's not only the quality education model, but a recent study by Achieve Incorporated, which is a national research organization, also found that Oregon lagged behind other states in the number of units required for graduation in English and mathematics. So we are looking at that very carefully. It's a complex issue. We know, for example, that even though only 2 units of math are required for graduation, we know that significant numbers of students take more than the minimum to graduate. So we're trying to analyze not only what is the current policy minimum, but what's the actual level of course taking. So we would have a better idea of how many additional sections would have to be added in order for all students to achieve, for example, 3 units of mathematics. And that will give us a better idea of how many teachers would be required, and then, of course, what would that cost to add those additional teachers. there's an additional element here, Senator, that we are concerned about, and that is that we've seen dramatic teacher turnover. Actually, there's a chart in the report card that shows the reasons that teachers have left the profession in Oregon, and you'll notice that the retirement issue spikes dramatically over the last 3 years. And what that means is that we've been having to hire a lot of new teachers, and finding teachers with mathematics and science licenses has proven to be difficult. So it's not only how many teachers do we need, but do we have an adequate supply of those teachers, and can we recruit them either out of our university system or from other states? So it's a very, very important question. It's on the mind of all of us right now. We, in general, support the idea of adding more rigor to the Oregon high school requirements. But we are, before making a specific recommendation, we want to study this in more detail so that we have a clear fiscal impact before making any further recommendations.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you, Dr. Burt. Have you considered, seriously considered, using resources within the community that are not, you know, don't have a master's in education, but that are scientists or are mathematicians or, you know, that sort of thing?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, yes, we have, and I know you asked that question yesterday. I think it's a very good one. For example, Senator Wisnett, or Representative Wisnett, just asked the question about troops to teachers. This is an area where people with professional training, particularly military training, that in some cases is some of the best in the world, but may not have a degree in education. Troops to teachers allows us to recruit those individuals and to offer tuition reimbursement for them to get the coursework that they need to be licensed as a teacher. There are a variety of ways that people can work in schools. I might mention, for example, charter schools, where people are not up to half the staff in an Oregon charter school does not have to have an Oregon license to teach in that school. And also say, I happen to sit on the board of the Oregon and Southwest Washington Junior Achievement Program, and there are thousands of business people in our state who volunteer every week to work in Oregon schools, and I can tell you, a little commercial for my organization, there is a shortage of volunteers. We have far more requests from Oregon teachers for junior achievement help than what we have volunteers. So there are a number of ways that expertise in the private sector can be used in schools.
Follow up, please.
Yes,
Senator. Mr. Chair, Dr. Burt, on the license requirement on teachers, is that a statutory requirement or is that an administrative rule? And then just to follow up on your volunteer, I would hope that your Department of Education would look more closely at retired educators as volunteer tutors. I mean, it's something that they do very well. They have time on their hands, and it's a win-win situation.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, agree wholeheartedly. In terms of your first question, the alternative licensure pathways that are available are in administrative rule. They are in the administrative rules that relate to the operation of Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. I'm assuming at some point you may have Vicki Chamberlain before your committee, and she can explain in more detail the alternative ways that people can be licensed in the state. And the use of volunteers in the classroom, particularly retired teachers, is highly sought after. There are two programs that make very effective use. One is the SMART program that does recruit a variety of people from the business sector as well as retired teachers. And the other is a program operated by OASIS, which recruits retired teachers and retirees in general to volunteer in Oregon schools. And certainly encourage anyone who has that interest to seek out ways to do that.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, one yes. Further. The retired Oregon Retired Educators Association,
yes,
is also another major source of those potential tutors.
Absolutely.
Senator Gordley and then Representative March.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. An additional request, Dr. Burke. During the interim, the Senate Education Committee heard a report from the department on early options programs in the state of Oregon. And I'd like to request that that report be made available to our committee, Mr. Chair. It documents how we're doing as a state in making opportunities for high school students to take a course or courses at a community college or university, what that looks like statewide. There are opportunities, but they're fragmented, not necessarily a system. And if you could provide that document, it would be very helpful.
Be happy to.
Thank you.
Representative March.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At some point, I'd like to get some more information on the special education population that we're dealing with. It's our total school age population, our school number of students has gone up by 8%, but some of the categories of autism has gone up by 581%. Other health impairment, and that's a real broad category, and also the largest, one of the largest other than the specific learning disability, is gone up 518%. And then, although it's a small number, traumatic brain injury has gone up significantly, 560%. If we could get a little more information background, I mean, does part of this reflect the mainstreaming of the special populations, and or are there some things going out there that we should be aware of that maybe we can work on?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Representative March, we have a task force that's working on many of those issues related to the increases in those populations, particularly those that are low incidence but high cost. And that has been, that we have had legislative assembly members participate in that, and we can give you a very thorough report on that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Burke. And
thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm also, I must say, delighted and pleased that you're using the document, even as we talk this morning. So if other questions come up, like those that Representative March just asked, please let us know. It's the data are designed for your use as policymakers. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Fleming, shall we go on to your next?
Mr. Chair, yes, absolutely. I just want to take the opportunity to reinforce the notion that all of the information that Dr. Burke just presented comes with a significant workload in the agency for managing that, collecting it on behalf of school districts, managing it qualitatively and analyzing it and giving it back to you in graphs and charts that make some sense. So, again, I just want to reinforce that that's part of the reinvention and the transformation. At this point, if you turn back to the section in your packet, starting with slide 54, hopefully Brian and I can coordinate our presentation and the slides that you'll be looking at, but the state school fund formula and the mechanics of that. And I'll just turn it over to Brian.
Mr. Reeder, one thing I would like to note for the committee is we will have about an hour today, actually about 55 minutes, but we are going to also do a very extensive additional presentation on the State School Fund next week. So people will have a lot of time for questions if they have questions. So please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Devlin, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brian Reeder. I'm the director of the Policy and Research and Analysis section at the Department of Education. What I would like to do today is step you through at somewhat of a high level, step you through the state school funding formula. And the formula can get complex in certain areas. It can be daunting to try and understand all the pieces. So I'm going to step through it, try to touch on the pieces individually. And if you have questions, please interrupt me, and so we can get clarity before we continue, because confusion can compound itself as we go. So what I'd like to do now is really give you the overview of the formula. As I said, if you look at slide 55, and let me put my glasses on, I'm not getting any younger. slide 55 really shows you all the pieces of what is going on with the formula, from the establishment of the amount in the state school fund through where it goes and how it goes to those places. So I'm going to start here. First of all, slide 56 gives you a sense of where the revenues that go into the state school fund come from. Really, on the appropriation side, three sources: the general fund, the lottery, and then the common school fund. And in reality, the common school fund monies flow out to districts and then represent, in the formula calculations, they represent local revenue, but in effect they are, they originate with the state and are appropriated by the legislature. And on the other side, the Education Stability Fund, which is a rainy day fund. It has, at the moment, virtually no money in it, but it can be a source of revenue in the future if some balances are built up. Put those all together, and what you have is the state school fund. Just for your reference, the state school fund in the 03-05 biennium was $4.9 billion. The governor's proposed budget for 05-07 is $5 billion. Dig a little bit into the details now on the distribution side. Slide 57 shows that there really are four big chunks, four broad categories of where the money goes, and the first two are the ones on the ends of the slide here that you'll see. The left end is this, a grant program for small high schools that was put in place in the 01-03 biennium, was renewed for the 03-05 biennium, and it provides a relatively small amount grants to small high schools to provide them additional resources. It is recognized that smaller schools are more expensive to run, and this grant was designed to provide some more resources to small high schools.
Excuse me, Representative Wisnett.
Yes, sir. You state that it's more expensive, but I've been told that the small schools have excess budget money. Does ODE look at the individual school district budgets to see how much money they're spending and how much is in their reserve fund? Or
Chair Devlin, Representative Wisnett, we do have that data. We know how much each district receives in revenue. We know how much they spend, and therefore we can calculate their ending balances. I have not taken a systematic look at that data recently. I have not heard that we have schools in Oregon that have large excesses, but it is possible. And I'm happy to look at that data and provide it to you.
Thank you, sir. As a follow-up, Mr. Chair, then I'd like to have that data, so if we have to make a decision on removing that sunset or continuing that program, I'd like to know if we really need to fund that.
Thank you. Please proceed.
On the other end of this graph, the box labeled special education account, those are dollars that go to long-term care and treatment programs and hospital education programs in Oregon, as well as to fund the School for the Deaf and the School for the Blind, which are schools run by the state of Oregon. The dollars for those two programs, the small high school and the special education account, come off the top of the state school fund before we start distributing money to districts or to ESDs through the formulas. So those monies are taken right off the top.
Chair?
Yes.
Could you explain that? It seems to me that isn't there a special budget item in whatever bill we're looking at, 5909, that has $17 million for the school for blind or school for deaf? Is that? But I just thought you said you took that off the top, or how does that, is that different than the $5 billion? I guess that's my point. Am I making myself clear there?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, you're asking about the two slides that we referenced yesterday, and the Special schools is an appropriation in our grant and aid budget, and it is included in the overall appropriation for the state school fund.
It's a part of the $5 billion.
Better get the expert up here.
So you take that out.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Brett West, Assistant Superintendent for Finance and Administration. There is a separate appropriation of $17 million approximately for the schools for the blind and deaf. In addition to that, there is a small amount that shows up in the other fund column. I shouldn't say a small amount, a relatively small amount compared to $5 billion. That's taken off the top for our special education purposes. I believe that's for students with IEP. So that's individual education plans under the Special Education Act. And so that money is used in addition to the regular appropriation to help students with special needs that qualify under the Individuals with Disabilities Act.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Devlin. Just to clarify that a little bit, if we jump forward to slide 59, it shows a breakdown there of that special education account. Part of it going to long-term care and treatment in the hospitals, and the other part, as Brett mentioned, for special ed at the deaf and blind school. So those would be the amounts from the state school fund in addition to the direct appropriation for those schools. Back up now to slide 58. We'll get into the distribute, really the guts of the formula, which is how the money is distributed to school districts. And I will, before I get into the school district formula, let me just touch on the ESD formula here. As you probably know, over the last two biennia, the legislature redesigned the distribution formula for ESDs. That formula now is driven on a weighted student basis, just like the school district formula is, so that each ESD receives roughly the same amount of money for each of the weighted students of the districts, of their constituent districts. So really the two formulas are driven by the same student numbers, and so I won't go into any detail for the ESD formula, but just know that it follows the district formula very closely.
Clarification on that. Would that be all ESDs receiving approximately the same per student or per ADMW? When you say by district, I know the formula was equalized, but are they receiving approximately the same per ADMW within their area?
Chair Devlin, that's correct. It works the same way as the district formula in that the formula determines how much each ESD will receive per student and then looks at how much they raise in local revenue, and the state would then make up the difference. And so each ESD does receive a combination of local and state revenue of roughly the same amount per weighted student. The only exceptions would be that there is a floor on the distribution so that the very smallest ESDs would receive a minimum of $1 million per year.
A clarification on that. Maybe we could do this some other time, actually, but if that's possible, when you say that they receive, in comparison to their districts, the portion that's local and then state revenue, that must involve at least some transfers of revenue. Some, obviously, ESDs have some property tax assessment capabilities, at least most of them do, but that I'm just trying to figure out what the mechanics of this are, is how money is transferred to make them all equivalent. And
Mr. Chair,
yes.
We'd be happy to show you a complete breakout of local and state revenues that fund the ESD system as a follow-up.
Okay. I would appreciate that. And for the committee, we are being going to be asked to look very closely at ESDs during this particular session, so that's why I'm asking for the level of detail. Please proceed.
Chair Devlin, just briefly what may help clarify. Currently, ESDs receive somewhat right around $300 per weighted student. And, for example, if a particular ESD raised $200 per weighted student from local property taxes, then the state would pay them the remaining $100 to bring them up to $300. If, in contrast, the ESD raised only $100 from property taxes, the state would kick in the remaining $200 to equalize everyone at $300.
On a statewide basis, not on...
I'm
sorry to belabor this with the committee, but when I first heard you on a comparison to the districts in their area, what I was hearing is we have districts that are going all the way from, well, there are some even higher than that, but I know of some districts where 70% of 68% is coming locally, and maybe some others where 17 or 18% is coming locally. So I was just getting a little bit confused by your earlier statement. So,
Chair Devlin, we will be happy to provide that breakdown by district for you. There is a large range there.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I just add that there's a URL on the bottom of this slide that refers to the spreadsheet that we mentioned yesterday, which is a place where you can go to look at the current calculations. ESDs are one of the pages on that linked workbook.
Okay. Please proceed.
Thank you. Slide 58 really starts to get into the guts of the district distribution formula. And again, there are a number of parts here, and I'll address the three on the right first, the facility grant, the transportation grant, and the high-cost disability grant. These are grants given to districts based on characteristics of the districts. They are taken off the top of the school fund prior to distributing the money that goes out on a per-student basis. And as an example, the facility grant, which is provided to districts that have built new schools or have renovated or added on to schools, provides them additional money to supply those new buildings or renovated buildings with things like desks and other things that they are not allowed to use bond money for. That's about $17.5 million per biennium. The transportation grant, as you know, is a reimbursement, either 70%, 80%, or 90%, depending on how high a district's transportation costs are, reimbursement of their transportation expenditures. That grant is on the order of $170 million per year, or about $350 million a biennium. And then the high-cost disability grant is intended to provide grants to districts that have very high-cost special education students. We have districts who have individual students where they're spending on the order of $100,000 a year to serve that student, and that presents a financial burden on districts, particularly small districts. So this fund reimburses them for any expenses above $25,000 for individual students that are very high cost. Once those three grant amounts are taken off the top, the remaining part of the state school fund is distributed on a per weighted student basis. And each district gets almost exactly the same amount per weighted student with only a couple variations, and I will get into that in a moment. But first of all, I want to talk about what we mean by a weighted student. This is one area where the formula can be confusing, but it is really the key to understanding how our formula works. If we go to slide 60, I'll try to describe to you how the weighting works, but first I want to talk about really three pieces in here that depart a little bit. They're adjustments to the distribution that aren't strictly considered weights. And the first one is the adjustment for teacher experience. In the formula, we calculate the average teacher experience for each district in the state and then compare that to the state average. And if a district has experience higher than the state average, then they get additional money through the formula. For each year of experience above the state average, they get an additional $25 per weighted student. And the rationale behind that is more experienced teachers have higher salaries. Districts need more money to pay those salaries. On the flip side, if a district has less experience than the state average, then they would get less money, $25 per weighted student less for each year of experience that they are below the state average. So that's an adjustment that's made. The other two adjustments that exist, and they're in the middle of this graph, you can see it refers to them as Union High School, Unified School District, and elementary schools. In Oregon, we have one district that remains a high school-only district. That's the Crane District in Harney County. We also have six or seven elementary schools, also all in Harney County, that are elementary-only districts. And so in those cases, the high school-only district is adjusted upward. Its ADM prior to the weighting is adjusted upward by 20% to give it more money based on the notion that high schools are more expensive to run than elementary schools. And the elementary-only districts are adjusted downward by 10%, again, to reflect lower costs relative to other schools.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Walker.
Yes, thank you. I have a question about that. You indicate Harney County is the only one with this situation. Could you explain why?
Senator Walker, in the 1980s, Oregon went through a consolidation of school districts, right. One of the goals of that consolidation, or one of the requirements, was that every district in the state offer all grades, K through 12. But exceptions were made for these schools, and I wasn't part of that discussion, but my understanding is that given their circumstances in such a sparsely populated county that is geographically so large that they were exempted from that requirement, so that we have this series of very small districts out there that remain either high school only or elementary only. I don't know, beyond that, I don't know the history of that.
Okay. Thank you.
Please proceed.
Now what I'd like to do is really get into the main weights that go into the formula. And let me start out by giving you some perspective on sort of the number of students that we have in Oregon. We count students in three different ways in Oregon. The first way is we take a head count on October 1st each year. Just count the number of students enrolled in public schools on that day. And in the 03-04 school year, we had just over 551,000 students. The second way we count students is on the number of students that we have on an average day. And at this method of counting students, it starts to get into the reason we do that is for funding purposes. We're starting to get into the formula now. So we count students on a daily, average daily basis, what we call ADM, or average daily membership. And in 03-04, we had 528,000 students in average daily membership. Now, that's considerably below the 551,000 headcount on October 1st. There are really two reasons for that. And the biggest one is kindergartners are counted at 0.5 in the ADM number. So we, for funding purposes, since most kindergarten programs are half day, we count kindergartners at half a student in ADM. We count them as a full student in the head count. So we eliminate quite a few in those two counts. That explains most of the difference. And the remaining difference is accounted for primarily by dropouts. Students who start school are in school on October 1st, but for a variety of reasons drop out of school and therefore don't show up for the full year in the ADM numbers. And the the final count of students that we use is the one that we use directly in the formula, and that is weighted students, or what we call average daily membership weighted, and that starts out with average daily membership and then adds the weights to it. And in 03-04, we had just shy of 648,000 weighted students. So we're adding on the order of 120,000 weights to the program, to our count of students when we go through this weighting process.
Mr. Reeder, actually, this is just more of a comment and more meant for Ms. Fleming. I've heard from a number of auditors of school districts that it appears to them, in because of the necessity, particularly on a daily basis, of accounting for ADM, that some medium-sized school districts are devoting up to two to three FTE, just to keep their counts. And very large school districts like Portland, that number might be considerably larger. I also was told by a former superintendent who was a former member here that the old system kind of had its drawbacks also, which was you rounded up as many kids as you could get at the beginning of the year. And then I think you may have had to do it at the end of the year also, but you rounded up as many kids as you could get at the end of the year. And it's kind of interesting because when I hear this, the comment I get is that, logically, this is a considerable devotion of resources that are basically just counting kids. But I'm just wondering if there is some better way to do this. And I don't really have a solution for a better way to do this. But it does seem in this time of fiscal constraints that forcing school districts to keep truancy is a different issue, but keeping them to just basically do counts every day to justify their funding doesn't seem to me to be a very wise use of resources.
Mm-hmm. Chair Devlin, as the way that we count ADM on a daily basis is each school records whether a particular student is present or absent for that day, which I think is useful information for them, independent of sending that data to the state for funding purposes. We are trying very hard to streamline that process to make counting students for them easier and to make reporting students to us easier for them, and that is much of the rationale behind the student-level data systems that we are creating, and the integrated data system that has been proposed is to increase the efficiency by which districts keep track of their students, whether they're present or absent on a given day.
Senator Whitsitt had a follow-up.
Chair Devlin, it's come to my attention from a couple of different schools, from teachers who have told me this, that the schools will actually, when someone transfers, the child transfers out of the school, will keep them on the books for about 10 days, which adds to the dollars that they get. It also causes them to show up as absentees, which makes it more difficult for them to reach performance standards.
Chair Devlin, Senator Whitsitt, under current law, a district is allowed to keep a student in their ADM count for 10 days if they don't know what happened to that student, if they don't know why that student is not in school. If they have knowledge that that student has transferred to another district, then they are required by law to remove that student from their records immediately. We have heard anecdotal evidence that districts are not doing that, that they keep those students on for the full 10 days, even though they have a pretty good idea that that student has gone to another district or has moved out of state. This is another area where our student-level data system is going to solve this problem for us. We will know immediately when that student shows up in another district, so districts will no longer be allowed to claim that student if that student is not enrolled in their district.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to just take the opportunity to go back to that previous comment about the amount of FTE devoted to keeping track of who's actually in school or not as an issue of accountability. And I think in questioning about what the role of the agency is and what the role of the system is, if, in fact, we want to know who's in school every day and what we're paying those districts to provide that education, then we have to have some system to collect that information and give it back to you. For every one of those districts that has a great deal of FTE devoted to that function, there are exceptions in the system where perhaps we are questioning now where the money actually does get spent and how it gets counted. I'll give you the example of alternative education programs. And we have discussed internally the possibility of a statewide audit, effectively, of alternative education programs to make sure that districts are, in fact, placing students in alternative programs, and that money, the transaction for that money and the oversight of those programs is being handled effectively. And we have had questions that have been triggered by some recent events in one of our ESDs that has caused us to ask more questions. So, it's again, I just want to point out it's that balance of how much do we want to know, how much quality do we want in the information that we have, and what do we do to make better decisions with it.
Senator Nelson had a question.
Yes, thank you. When you're talking about these average day attendance, one of the issues in my district, and particularly in the West End where we have a lot of migrant workers, some of our elementary schools, and this is a high figure, it seems like they end up with like a 20 or 25% reduction. I mean, these children of these workers will be there in October, but in November, December, January, February, maybe sometimes into March, they're gone. Mm-hmm. And it sounds to me like it's huge. Now I'm going to have to check on that, but how does that all figure into, I mean, where do you finally end up saying, okay, this is the amount of children that we're going to actually fund you for?
Chair Devlin, Senator Nelson, the way the ADM count works is it's a count of students who are enrolled on a given day. So if those students withdraw when they leave your district, then they would not be counted for funding purposes. If they at then some point during the year return, then they would start being counted again. So in that case, if you have a lot of movement of students in and out of the district, or in particular if they're leaving for extended periods and then coming back, then they would be counted for only part of the year, in effect, and would be funded for only part of the year.
And then, excuse me, yes. So then, do you make these payments, how often do you make these payments? Is it quarterly or monthly? Or I mean, how does...
Chair Devlin, Senator Nelson, the payments are made monthly with the exception of June. We make a double payment in July to start the school year, to start the fiscal year, and then no payment in the following June. So there are 11 monthly payments.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
Okay, now, how do we get from ADM of roughly 528,000 up to ADMW, or weighted students of 658,000. There are really three primary categories of weights here, and the first and by far the largest is students on IEPs, special education students. Special education students get a double weight. a double weight. In other words, they get the basic first weight plus one additional weight for a total of two. In 03-04, we special education weights totaled just above 61,000 additional weights. Under current law, a district can get up to 11% of their total students would qualify for special education weights. So if a district, for example, has 13% of their students who are on IEPs, they would get the additional weight for only 11% of those. That was a limit established in law.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And thank you, Mr. Reeder. I need to stop you there because I know that there's a number of districts who far exceed that 11%. How long ago was that 11% set? And when are we planning on looking at it again? I suppose that's my question, my decision, but...
Chair Devlin and Senator Walker, my understanding is that 11% was set when the formula was initially instituted back in the early 90s. Raising that limit has been discussed numerous times in the past few sessions, but no action has been taken. I will tell you, though, that in the last session, the legislature established a separate fund to fund the very high-cost students, and that, in some sense, takes some pressure off districts who have a lot of special ed students, particularly if they have a lot of very high-cost ones, because they would get additional money through that mechanism. But you're right. There are quite a few districts. In fact, most of the districts in the state, maybe only a handful of exceptions, have more than 11% of their students on IEPs.
Do you have a, Mr. Chair, if I could ask, do you have a chart in here that shows that? I'm sure that's a piece of data you can whip out very quickly over the 198 school districts.
Yeah. Chair Devlin, Senator Walker, we don't have that in this presentation, but we do have that data, and we will get into that detail next week.
Okay. I'll look for it next week then. Thank you.
Just a brief comment, though, for the committee, and I know there's others on the committee that have been through this before. Since the adoption of the formula, there have been a number of modifications, but literally every time you try to change anything of any major context in the formula, you end up with winners and losers. And usually that has led to no significant modifications in the formula. So please proceed, Mr.
The second largest category of added weights in the formula is for students who are served by English as a second language programs. That weight is a half weight, so each of those students is weighted at 1.5, and that weight adds roughly 26,000 weighted students to the count. And then there are three categories of weights that are at the 0.25 level. Students in poverty receive an additional 0.25 weight. Students served in foster homes receive a 0.25 weight, and students who are identified and served in facilities for neglected and delinquent children also receive an extra 0.25 weight. Those three categories add an additional 21,000 weighted students to the count. And then final category of weights based on student characteristics, students who are either pregnant or who are parents of children receive an additional full weight, so they receive two weights, and that adds a roughly 1,400 more weights to the system. And then a final category of weights, which is really not based on student characteristics, but it is based on school and district size, is what we call the small school correction. And that is the mechanism in the formula that directs additional dollars to very small schools in the system. There are two components to that. The small remote component provides additional weightings to districts that have very small schools that are more than 12 miles away from the nearest school, next nearest school. And then also a component of that for small high schools, which is separate because the distance component of that requirement was eliminated. So for elementary schools, we still have a distance requirement. For high schools, we don't. And those two components add roughly another 10,000 weights to the system, bringing us up to right around 648,000. At this point, there is one final component to the weighting system, and that is what we call weighted students extended. And I'm sure you've all heard of this, and that is a district receives the number of students they had this year or the prior year, whichever is greater. And so for districts that are losing enrollment, they will be funded on the number of students they had in the prior year to give them additional dollars. The rationale behind that is that when you're losing enrollment, you have certain fixed costs that don't go away as your students depart. and therefore this provides a small amount of additional funding for those districts who are shrinking in size. So now that adds roughly another 10,000, 10 to 11,000 students to the overall count, bringing us up to just right around 659,000 weighted students in the 03-04 school year. At this point, based on that student count and the amount of money available in the state school fund, the department establishes how much money is sent out per weighted student to each district. That amount currently is slightly below $5,000 per weighted student. Is expected to rise slightly in the 05-07 biennium because of the small increase in the governor's proposed budget. And I believe with that, we'll...
Maybe a clarification for my Mr. Reeder on the extended, which appears to me to have been a replacement for the old. I don't know what the term, remember the terminology, but there was like a stop loss provision, basically that we used to have in the formula, that districts that were losing population were held harmless in a sense, and so this extended is just a way to smooth that out. Is that the purpose of it? I'm talking about when you said that a district could take either their count this year or their count last year. This is just a way to smooth that out, isn't it? Or
Chair Devlin, yes, in a sense. The old stop-loss mechanism was really part of a transition into the new formula so that the districts who would get fewer resources in the new formula didn't face those cuts all at once. The use of prior year weighted students, if it's larger than current year, is a similar kind of thing, but also primarily is to recognize that as a district loses students, it has fixed costs that
right.
that really take time to adjust to, and so it gives them sort of a one-year reprieve from those declining revenues.
But you indicated that one factor added about 10,000 to the ADMW. Was that the figure?
That's correct. 10,000 statewide.
So that would mean that there are a lot of school districts experiencing losses in populations. I mean, that's a pretty significant number. 10,000.
Chair Devlin, yes, roughly two-thirds of the districts in Oregon are losing population.
Yes. Senator Gordley.
Representative Wisnant had his hands up.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No. No, ma'am.
Just a couple of questions, and I'm struggling with how to frame them. The weights are related to funding, but not necessarily to student outcomes. It's a funding formula. It doesn't have anything to do with what we hope to see as an outcome for any class of students.
Chair Devlin, Senator Gordley, yes, the weighting system is a mechanism to distribute funds, and its purpose is to try to identify, based on student characteristics, which districts need additional resources to serve those students with those characteristics. So we identify special ed as a category of students that we think need more resources in order to achieve some sort of outcome. We identify limited English proficient students as a category of students that we think need more resources to achieve some level of outcome. We identify students in poverty. But you are correct in that we have not made, or the formula has not made, an explicit statement about, with these additional resources, we expect those students to perform as well as all other students.
That's sort of what I'm getting at, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to relate the formula to outcomes, but then also to the quality education model and the funding level that's recommended there. that would hopefully get us to certain outcomes for all students. Again, I'm struggling with how to frame the question. Help me.
Okay. Chair Devlin, Senator Gorelick. Well, I think what you've touched on is really, in my mind, one of the key policy issues facing the legislature, and that is, are we getting the resources to the places they need to be in order for students who currently are not achieving as well as we'd like them to get them up to close that achievement gap, in essence? And we recently started looking at that issue as it relates to ESL students. We send out the additional half weight through the formula, and that translates into dollars that go to those districts with those students. And two issues come up. Are they spending those dollars on those programs, and how are those ESL students doing relative to other students?
Exactly. And thank you for helping me reframe it. And again, I'm hearing that this is a formula that was defined and adopted in the 90s. But we have new experiences, and we have a whole cast of different students, shifts in demographics. There's so much new information to consider that isn't a part of the formula that we're working, which is based on an old, kind of an old paradigm, if you will.
Yeah. Chair Devlin, Senator Burley, that I think that's exactly correct. And one thing the department is doing now is developing with the new data that we have and the better data that we have, both on student outcomes and on our funding and how those resources are spent both at the district and at the school building level, is to develop models that help us understand how resources affect student performance and, you know, how those vary depending on student characteristics. And so we're doing more and more work in that area to better understand those relationships, and the results of that work should, you know, imply some things for whether the weights, current weights in the formula, are the appropriate ones or not. But as Senator Devlin points out, you always create winners and losers when you suggest changing those weights. And so it becomes really a very, both a policy issue and a political issue.
And I appreciate that. And I think we're all focused on, and this is not an admonition to you, but we're focusing on having all of our children be winners. So at some point, we have to step away from being stuck in that place that says we can't do this because, and look at what is it we need to do differently to reach all of our children.
Chair Devlin, Senator Gorelick, and you know, we are doing more and more at the department in trying to understand those relationships in an effort to help you, to provide you with the information and the analysis that helps you make better decisions in that regard.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
We have one more question also. Did you have any more, Senator?
No, thank you.
Representative Wisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Reeder, the number of students per weighted, could you give us that? I missed the numbers. I was trying to keep up with your 26,000, 21,000. Could you provide us a list how you, the numbers that you came up to get down to the 649? I think that would be how many students per each weighted factor?
Chair Devlin.
I've learned how to do this. I keep getting my questions. During the interim, I was on the House Education Committee, and we had the revenue office, legislative revenue office, come in and talk to us about the school formula. I think it's important that we were told by these people that the school formula in 1991 was created anticipating it would be changed. And as the senator has said, you know, it's 14 years or 13 years now, and it has not been changed. Do other states use a similar type formula? And does ODE, have they ever recommended changes, or could ODE recommend changes to the school formula? Also, during our interim, it was clear that these weighted funds, there's no way to track that they go to those students that we're giving the additional funds to. So we have a system where we're saying we're going to give these additional funds for a specific purpose, but we have no way to track to be sure those funds get spent for those students, as the senator talked about. Thank you.
Chair Devlin, Representative Wisnett, with the new data system we created from 6 years ago, what we refer to as the database initiative, we do have a method of tracking how those funds are spent. We do not have a requirement in the law that those funds be spent on those activities, but we do have a way of telling whether they were or not. So we do have that data.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, I think the comments of both Senator Gordley and the representative really speak to why we need to make a change in the way we do business. And the issue of performance in the system is one that the agency is trying very hard to understand and point out where the intervention needs to happen and perhaps where the funding needs to be directed to accommodate those interventions based on what the data is telling us about the student population. So in our way of looking at it, it is as much or more about that as it is about targeting two specific populations. It is what are the results that we're getting in the system, and if we know the research says that there are certain interventions that work better for certain strategies with certain students, we ought to be spending our money there where we know it works, as opposed to a variety of other things that may not be founded in research. So we want to be sure and have the opportunity to address the question that came up yesterday about the $10,000 or $11,000 per student, and Brian has some information that we'd like to share before we close, if that's all right.
Yes. Chair Devlin, I brought a couple of tables that I believe Sue will pass out. Really want to address two questions. The first had to do with additional federal money flowing to Oregon in the coming biennium relative to 0305. And I'll let her get that passed out first.
If you want to give a brief explanation of this today and then we can come back for questions tomorrow, that would be helpful. And also, I'd like to give Senator Gordley a chance now just to say something briefly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to take a moment to acknowledge and introduce Janelle Bell. Would you please stand? A former student member of the Portland Public School Board, Janelle is now doing an internship in the governor's office, and it's just a delight to see you in this meeting and in other meetings that have been taking place around the building. And please know that one of these seats up here belongs to you.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you. Look first at the table labeled Department of Education Budget, and I won't go through this in detail, but this shows the sources of funds going into the budget and then the uses of funds, where those funds go. And I just draw your attention to the line item near the bottom called Federal Grants to Districts. $998 million we're expecting in 0507. That's up about $165 million from the prior biennium. So that there's been some discussion about additional federal money. That's the additional federal money, roughly $165 million.
Can we also make clear that there's an understanding that while some of that money may be broadly dispersed, a fairly large portion of that is targeted towards specific students with specific needs and shouldn't be looked at as if it's raising literally the funds available for all students in the state?
Mr. Chair, we'll be able to provide that information when we talk about programs and targeted grants when we get into that section.
And the second table, I think, gets at the issue raised yesterday by Senator Whitsitt, and that is how much are we spending per student? And this is an area where there is often confusion, and I want to clarify how the calculations are made. I believe in Senator Whitsitt's calculation yesterday, the $6.4 billion department budget, which is on that very first line there, divided by the number of students, comes out to 11,000. Well,
a biennium.
That's a biennial number, and it represents, first of all, not all of that money makes it to school districts. Some of that is for department operations. And second, it doesn't include local money.
which is important to include, and then putting it on an annual basis. So that's what I do in this table here, is start with the department's budget, remove things that don't flow into the state school fund, which you can see there, and then arrive at the state school fund of $5 billion. Then add to that local revenue through property taxes, local option property tax revenue, plus the Multnomah County income tax. That's the $213 million there. And then add back in state and federal money that goes out to districts, but not through the formula. It's money that goes out outside the funding formula. And we arrive at a biennial number of $8.9 billion. Then the bottom section of the chart divides that into the 2 years of the biennium, and then at that point divides it by the number of students we're expecting, and this is the definition of students here is the October 1 head count, which is traditionally the measure of students that both feds and nearly all states use in calculating per student amounts on the spending side. And it gives us numbers $7,900 in 05-06 and $8,200 in 06-07. So those are the annualized amounts, which represent really all the flow of funds to school districts on a per student basis. So I did want to make sure that we clarified those numbers. And one final point, if you go back up to the local revenue number, the 2544.9 number, that amount is up. That's an 0507 forecast from the Revenue Forecast Committee. That number is about $170 million higher than the prior biennium. That's the additional local money that people are talking about, and I would point out that in arriving at the essential budget level of $5.318 billion, that additional local money has already been taken into account, so that is does not represent unexpected revenue.
Just a follow-up on that, I don't have the exact percentages in front of me, but in the governor's budget he had indicated that the general fund increase, or general fund probably discretionary, was less than 2%. But when you considered that local revenue, the overall increase was only about 4% for the biennium. I believe those were his numbers.
Yes.
So in that range, I think it's... and when you compare that to increases in health care costs of 12%, and we all know how substantial the PERS increases could be. So, with that, we will adjourn until tomorrow morning. If the Department of Education would confer with Ms. McGlashan, and we will see how we can organize things for the rest of the week.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I wanted to make note that we do have a recycle bin in this room now, and I think we're going to get them in all the hearing rooms. I made that request yesterday.
Thank you.
Yeah. Ask and ye shall receive.